who's just driven all the way from California to get here to speak to us, probably doesn't need or want an introduction.
I don't need or want an introduction.
But
I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
He asked for one. He asked for one because he hasn't finished his speech yet. So
on the last page.
I'm gonna go on really briefly then, so that he can finish his speech. Anyway, John is a good friend of our free school here in Albany, so we're glad to welcome him back. The first time he spoke in Albany a number of years ago, he didn't let me introduce him, so it's actually nice to have the chance. For those of you who don't know John, as I was saying, John is one of those powerful voices that came from inside the public school system. He was a teacher in the New York City schools for over 25 years.
30.
Over 30 years. And you're never going to finish your speech if you keep correcting me. He taught in all kinds of schools all over the city. And eventually, they named him the New York... Well, they first named him the New York City Teacher of the Year more than once. And then finally, they named him the New York State Teacher of the Year in 1990-something. I don't remember which year. And at that point in John's career, he saw what they were trying to do. And so what John did on the day that he was to receive what is a very prestigious award in New York State is, for his acceptance speech at the ceremony where they presented him the award, he gave his resignation speech because he, by that point, had decided that he could no longer teach in the system that wanted to acknowledge him for genuine creativity as a teacher. And so he resigned. And the story was covered on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And that's where I say that, you know, when an insider speaks out, it tends to carry even more power. Because we're all like, wow, but he teaches there. He's been in that water for all those years. He knows what he's talking about. Yeah, it ran in the Wall Street Journal. And then that whole year, I know this because John ended up in Albany at the end, what the New York State Teacher of the Year, believe it or not, is kind of like Miss America. No. No, because for the year of their reign, they go around to all these important, you know, annual meetings, and they get to give speeches. And so what John did, of course, and now meanwhile, they've given him this award, they're stuck with him for an entire year, and of course, he used the opportunity at all these high-profile events, you know, to tear the system down, which has been John's goal now for about 10 years. And it culminated in Albany at the annual meeting of the New York State School Boards Association, which was held in this huge banquet room underneath the Empire State Plaza there in Albany. And there were the school board's members from all over New York State. There were hundreds of people there. And so Mary Loya, who founded our school, and myself and a number of other free school teachers, we crashed the party. We'd already become ghetto groupies anyway. So we snuck up there, and we snuck in, and we sat at our own table. And John got to give the next to last speech of that long event. And he gave a really hard speech, and I won't tell you what he said. It was a very tough speech. And then every year, the tradition was for the Commissioner of Education to follow and give the final speech. And if you could have seen the expression on the Commissioner's face coming up to the podium following the speech that John had given, I mean, it was just, we were cracking up. The six of us were just, and the Commissioner was, he just had no blood in his face. All of the other school board members, the other 450 people were just looking at us, you know, with murderous stares. And it was hysterical. I'm sorry you all couldn't have been there. So, have you finished yet?
Say again?
Have you finished yet? You ready?
The theme of that talk to the School Boards Association was that they should not rubber stamp the decisions of the school bureaucracy. And that, I think, is what choked the commissioner, since these schools couldn't function if the school boards didn't rubber stamp all the decisions. I know my wife was the treasurer of a Manhattan school board, and she wasn't a rubber stamper. So you can look up what happened to her in the New York Times Index for the year 1983. I'm getting signals from the cameraman that I'm doing something wrong. If I want to be a movie star.
Leave the mic alone. So did you finish your speech?
This talk is called okay. Some Stop Notes. Some. Thank you. It really is a privilege to be here. Jerry Mintz told me there are people here from 25 countries. That's amazing, and 26 if you include Albany. This is a formal presentation, but fortunately you get to see a movie in the middle of it. This is called Some Notes on Second and First Childhoods and a Conspiracy That Isn't a Conspiracy at All. Am I going to be able to show my second childhood slide or not? If not, I have a hard copy and I'm just going to pass it around. If somebody will make sure I get it back in a few hours, well, let's pass it around. What the hey? I also want to explain that I have a lot of reasons for sitting down. The first is that I'm 70 years old. The second is that I'm 70 pounds overweight. And the third is that on a kind of mad whim, about 3 weeks ago, instead of flying to California where I had business, I drove out, then drove back for this talk, got back a couple days ago, and drove to Montreal, Canada from Philadelphia yesterday, and drove from Montreal to here, and got here about 70 or 80 minutes ago. That's why I'm sitting down. I'm so tired that I couldn't put my socks on. And I want you to see that. So I'm going to use it as a hanky. I also would like to tell you a quick impromptu story about speakers who sit down. Just before Christopher Lash died, and he was one of the great heroes and inspirations in my life. If you're from other countries, you may not know of Lash, but he's a great, clear social thinker who wrote for 30 or 40 years in this country. And right before he died, because they didn't know that was going to happen, the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan offered a free lecture series with Lash. So I signed up, showed up, and sat in the first row. And what I saw, I'd never seen Lash at all. What I saw was a long table, mic'd, sort of like this short table is, and sitting right in the middle was a handsome man in a beautiful blue suit with a lovely tie, and he sort of had a beatific smile on his face. To the left and right of this man were two casually dressed older men. I mean, the kind you see school teaching in schools. There. And one of them spoke for about 10 minutes introducing Lash, and people became rude in the audience and said, "We came here to hear Lash." At which time, the second casually dressed man on the end of the table began to speak, and without any exaggeration, after 45 minutes, the audience was ready to kill. People were throwing things, walking out, shouting, "This is an outrage." And the speaker looked baffled, and finally someone with a timid voice made herself heard and said, "That is Christopher Lash." That must have killed Lash. Anyway, so this is some notes on first and second childhoods. I have in front of me, or I did, it's passing around the audience, right? Is it on the screen? Great. I have in front of me, or that's what I wrote here anyway, a full-page advertisement from The Economist, the issue of July 5th, 2003. It's an ad from the money management firm of Neuberger Berman. The photograph in this commercial message is one of an elderly gentleman, I'd estimate about 80 years of age, water skiing at a tremendous clip without the skis in his bare feet. The subtitle under the picture serves as its caption and reads in part, "We also specialize in second childhoods." The aggressive text below this caption, about 100 words in all, begins by saying, "You've spent a lifetime acting sensible, rational, and practical. When it comes time to let your hair down, or what's left of it, will you be prepared?" That's how the ad begins, and this is how it ends. After all, you want to make the most out of playtime, don't you? Neuberger Berman, by the way, won't take you on as a client unless you have a minimum of $500,000. And that qualifies you for their junk category, because they also have clients with $500 million being managed. So whoever it is that this outfit is encouraging to enter second childhood and play away their final years, they aren't poor. I'll bet some of you are thinking, how is he possibly going to connect this with school? I spent some years as an advertising copywriter, and I know that whatever agency cooked up the second childhood campaign, it also submitted other themes in mock-up to entice the rich. And the agency then presented at least three possibilities to the client, the money management firm, for consideration, after which due deliberation and argument took place at Neuberger, and it concluded in that selection. Now, I find it amazing, and I hope you do too, the two separate corporations concluded that the best way to appeal for funds to be placed in the care of strangers was to assume that the wealthy are terminally childish. And perhaps they are. I don't know. I'm neutral on that. Once you've been alerted to the overt signs of spectacular childishness in our culture, and that's about as spectacular as it gets, even beyond the obvious clue where television shows feature grown-ups eating worms, you'll find evidence everywhere, in our fast food, in our sport utility vehicles, in our foreign policy, in our shaky marriages, that an epidemic of childishness is upon us, which apparently has eaten its way into the command modules of our society, too. I think that's tied in some important way to the fashion in which we school children never to grow up. The word schooling itself hints at the real truth. For schools, even good schools, are primarily about collectivizing and denaturing individuals. Government schools do this so that the range of possible thoughts and behaviors can be statistically predictable. I hate to say this, but a whole lot of the alternative schools I've seen are childish places, too, like the government schools they are a reaction against. So I thought I'd use some of your time tonight talking about the condition of childishness and some of its practical uses, both in schools and in our society. We need to better understand what a sophisticated piece of social engineering the extension of childishness, even lifelong, as the Neuberger Berman ad shows, really is. Our bread and butter as a national economy literally depends upon most of us being childish. In the hopes that the younger spirits among you can find some way out of this trap, and I know Pat Montgomery is seething now. She says, if anyone will find a way out, where are you, Pat? If anyone will find a way out of this trap, it'll be the oldsters. But in the hopes that the younger spirits among you can find a way out of this trap, let me talk about some things that popular journalism never seems to get around to considering. The connection, for example, between childishness and boredom. Have you noticed how often superficial people report that they are bored? Frequent announcements of boredom are something that most of us in school teaching associate with middle-class childhoods. And in my experience, usually the more materially comfortable the family is, the more often its boys and girls seem steeped in boredom. Surely the octogenarian water skier you see in the ad back of me, the one who wants to make the most out of his playtime, is escaping the ennui of his sensible, rational, and practical past. He's making the most of his playtime through expensive and violent activity, almost as much fun as carpet bombing Serbia or shocking and awing Baghdad. Surely water skiing barefoot at 80 is the moral equivalent of war. And if doing that at 80 is making the most of playtime, even a dull reader ought to be able to figure out that quiet contemplation or a tidying up of one's affairs in preparation for death isn't making the most of playtime, that is. So I want to talk tonight about the mission assigned to schooling. And if you hear any sarcasm in my voice or irony, it really isn't there. The mission assigned to schooling formally was to make us childish by way of boredom and in many other ways. During my tenure as a school teacher, I became an expert in boredom because it was everywhere in my work world. When I asked the kids, as I often did, why they felt so bored, they would always give the same answers. They said the work was stupid, that it made no sense in their lives, that they already knew it. They said they wanted to be doing something real, not just sitting around. They said teachers didn't seem to know very much about their subjects, and clearly they weren't interested in learning more. And the kids were right. I knew, because I hung out with teachers. The teachers were every bit as bored as they were, and they didn't know much. Boredom is a common condition of school teachers. Am I telling you something you didn't know? Anyone who's hung around a teacher lounge for more than a few days can vouch for the low level of energy, the constant whining about kids, the dispirited attitudes to be found there. And in fairness, because I'm not here to teacher bash, who wouldn't get bored teaching students who are rude and interested only in grades, if even that? Teachers are themselves products of the same 12-year compulsory school programs that so thoroughly bore most of their students. And it gets worse. Teachers are trapped in intricate routines even more rigid than those imposed upon children. So who then is at fault? Each one of us is, I think. My grandfather taught me that. One afternoon when I was 7, I idly complained to him of boredom, only to receive a sharp, painful crack across my head and to hear a voice telling me I was never to use that term in his presence again. He said if I were bored, it was my own fault, nobody else's concern. I was to keep my boredom to myself. The obligation to amuse myself was entirely my own, and people who didn't know that were childish, to be avoided if possible. Over the years, I was able to pass that vital lesson on to as many students as I could. But among teachers and administrators, I found it futile to challenge the official wisdom that boredom and childishness were only a natural state for 13-year-old kids. I taught 8th grade. Often I found myself defying custom, even bending the law to disprove that. I actually had written breaking the law, which is what I did, but Harper's Magazine told me, I think they're going to publish part of this, maybe, if I'm lucky, I'll rap wood. They said bending the law would be better. By the time I finally retired in 1991, I had more than enough reason to think of schools with their long-term cell block style, their forced confinement for both students and teachers, their minute control of time, space, and text as factories of childishness. Genuine responsibility and worthwhile projects and associations had been almost completely stripped from student lives. The raw material out of which maturity has to be fashioned was strictly rationed by institutional schooling. No wonder the kids were childish, the teachers too. At the time, I couldn't see, however, any reason why classrooms had to be that way. I was innocent then of the intimate connection between the type of economy and the type of government that a nation has and the kind of schooling that it is driven to encourage. We can't change the way we school without profound consequences for this economy, and that is the reason why all official school reform ends with the pedagogy untouched, except for cosmetic alterations. If we depended upon small farms for our food, children would simply not be allowed to be as incompetent and as childish as we find them at the beginning of the 21st century. And if we relied upon small businesses and small armies to give us our wealth and our security, or if we relied upon tangible personal achievements to give us our status instead of money, the kind of schools we currently maintain would be impossible. My own classroom experience revealed clearly what other teachers, too, must learn along the way, yet keep to themselves for fear of reprisals. If our various leaderships wanted to, our political, our industrial, professional, social, religious, or institutional leaders, if they wanted to, then we could cheaply and easily jettison the old, stupid structures of schooling which cripple our children's lives. We could show kids how to take an education rather than merely how to receive a schooling. We could teach them that no teacher and no school can possibly give them an education. That includes the best. Educations do not happen serendipitously through any methodology, even a democratic one, but only through brutally hard work and personal risk-taking, through constant striving and constant self-examination. We could encourage the best qualities of youthfulness, like curiosity, resilience, and the development of fresh insight, simply by being more flexible about time, texts, tests, and the solitary challenges that people desperately need, by giving students what autonomy they need in order to take serious risks every now and then, and by arranging or encouraging frequent associations with competent people. But we don't do that, and the more I ask myself, why not? And the more I persisted in thinking like an engineer might think about the problems of schooling, the more I missed the real point. What if there is no problem with our compulsory schools? What if they are, the way they are, so expensively flying in the face of common sense and ancient experience about how kids actually learn things, not because they're doing something wrong, but because they're doing something right. What if leaving no child behind is an insurance policy against that dreadful moment when most of us might grow up and begin to think for ourselves? From one very important, and even I'll grant a lofty point of view, a managerial one, incomplete childish people are a good thing, not an evil one. And until you realize why these people think that way, why that makes sense from some perspective, you're in a hopeless position contending against it. Hiding away from the rude world in little enclaves and begging dribs and drabs of money constantly for survival, hoping against hope that the world will one day beat a path to your door because you can produce outstanding results, is to live in Never Never Land. Your opponents will eat you alive the moment it becomes inconvenient for them to keep you on the payroll. I hope all of you have read George Orwell's 1984, and if you haven't, that's your homework from this talk. Because what I'm about to say draws heavily on an insight of Orwell. From the point of view of the managers of society, alternative forms of schooling serve the same role in their comprehensive strategy as the leader of the underground, Goldstein, in Orwell's 1984, served the world of Big Brother. Goldstein may or may not have been legitimate, but he was a way to isolate, identify, and control any serious opposition to the status quo. The alternative of the underground in 1984 was just an insurance policy for the state. Now, in Carol Quigley's legendary volume, which Roland is going to announce because it slipped my mind, but he stole the copy in the Brooklyn Public Library. What is Quigley's book? Huh? Anyway, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It's an enormous and wonderful book, which is a little difficult to get your hands on. Quigley was Bill Clinton's personal, and you can see why, it's Bill Clinton's personal tutor at Georgetown, and he had a marvelous mind. In Tragedy and Hope, Quigley reveals that J.P. Morgan in the 1890s across the early 20th century took upon himself the job of underwriting the left all over the world, especially the radical left, secret organizations to overthrow governments. And his case to his fellow magnates was simply that he had the best intelligence system in the world. If you let these places go out of business, if you let them go out of business, how will you ever know what they're thinking about? How will you ever learn how to effectively stymie them? So you keep them alive. The great writer about conspiracies, Edward Epstein, who was my roommate at Cornell, told me while I was at Cornell that the Daily Worker would be out of business tomorrow if government agencies weren't compelled to subscribe to it. He said out of the 13,000 subscriptions, 10,000 of them are paid for by the U.S. government. Anyway, don't ever let an Italian start to get away from the script, because the next thing is we'll lock the doors and, you know, you'll never get out of here. The road to a cure for this disease of powerlessness is not by love alone. Part of it is built through an intense study of history, of philosophy, of politics, and of human motivation. The latter is, I believe, only gained through a close reading of literature, of religious books, of rhetoric, and other aspects that are in the traditional curriculum, but not exercised except at elite private boarding schools. Unfortunately, the last thing many alternative schools seem to value is intellectual development, and only with our tools of intellect, sharpened as sharp as we can make them, will we be adequately equipped to cross swords with the managers of schooling. One of the key questions is this: do we really need a systematic school institution at all, even if it were reformed in such a way as to please everyone in this room? I intend no disrespect to the notion of education, only to any scheme of forced schooling. Even democratic schools in the United States, and probably elsewhere, are beneficiaries of the compulsion laws, since the law says kids have to be somewhere authorized. Alternative schools inevitably catch a share of those panicked poor souls who are panicked by the prospect of public school. But do any of us, mainstream or alternative, need 4 or 5 or 6 classes a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year for 12 years, and then college, and before then preschool? Is this concentration of programmed routines, even good programmed routines, really necessary? Now, be precise if you think it is. Necessary for what? You can't hide any longer behind reading, writing, and arithmetic as the rationale, because 2 million happy homeschoolers have surely put that dishonest justification to bed by now. And even if the homeschoolers didn't exist, the considerable number of impressively successful names out of American history who didn't go through any 12-year school ringer should be enough to raise anyone's suspicions. Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, Lincoln, and many, many more, right up to this moment, weren't products of any school. Indeed, through most of this nation's history, the majority of our kids went neither to high school nor academy, just exactly like the majority of kids in modern Switzerland don't go to high school or academy. Yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Farragut, inventors like Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, writers like Melville, Twain, and Whitman, scholars like Margaret Mead, or like Francis S. Collins, current head of the Human Genome Project today, which surely is the most prestigious scientific job in the world. Not only is Collins homeschooled, but he's, by his own admission, a born-again Christian, although none of the accounts of Collins reproduce that. The New York Times made the mistake of doing an interview with him in which he said that that conclusion was intellectually inescapable. And you don't have to agree with that, but you do have to see the immense humor in that fact. And the immense humor in this fact. Ariel Durant, who co-wrote an enormous and very good multi-volume History of the World with her husband Will, was happily married to 28-year-old Will when she was 15. That's what the Ariel Durant website says. According to my own research back in a barn in Chenango County, she was 13, not 15. Was Will a sex maniac? Was Ariel a victim? Those are serious questions. They remained happily married for 52 years until Will's death. And the multi-volume History of the World they wrote made them millions and millions and millions of dollars because the Book of the Month Club used it as a premium for 25 years. I have 8 or 9 sets. You only need to read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. I mean, it's only 100 words, so that's your homework, too. 100 pages. Or Andrew Carnegie's, to realize that the whole concept of adolescence is a fantastic lie invented at the beginning of the 20th century by a fellow named G. Stanley Hall, who was Wilhelm Wundt's right-hand man, his first assistant at the University of Leipzig in Germany. He invented adolescence. And adolescence is a fantastic lie that supports the monumental jobs project called secondary school. Adolescence has been willed into existence as a pseudoscientific excuse to extend tutelage, as an aid in synthetically extending childhood. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I usually speak too rapidly to accept applause, but thank you. So adolescence has been willed into existence as a pseudoscientific excuse to extend tutelage, as an aid in synthetically extending childhood, as a tool of subordination in the interests of regulating society and regulating this particular kind of economy. And all of us have been carefully conditioned by continuous propaganda to think of success as necessarily some reciprocal of schooling. But this isn't so, except in those special rigged spots where licensing legislation, not necessity, makes it so. In today's Switzerland, the richest nation per capita in the world, less than 25% of the population has more than a grade school training. Are Swiss, then, less educated than Americans? The entire Swedish school sequence runs 9 years, not 12, saving that nation's people a huge taxation burden. Do you really believe that Swedes are less well prepared for life's exigencies than our own children? What exact purposes of education in America require such an excess of time and money to achieve? And I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm going to answer it. Math schooling of a compulsory nature has been a dream of philosophers and utopians at least since Plato, and not a single one of these men, and they were all men, cared a fig about reading, writing, or arithmetic. The reason they wanted to take hold of the children, out of sight of their parents, out of sight of the living world, was in order to modify their minds, their behaviors, their attitudes, and their outlooks. Mass schooling of a compulsory nature was not installed successfully anywhere until Prussia in the Germanies pulled off the trick between 1806 and 1819. That was a triumph, followed next by the United States in supposedly liberal Massachusetts in 1852, then by the District of Columbia inside the Beltway in 1865, 13 years later. So this was a hard sell wherever it was offered. The final holdout in this corner of the world was Mississippi, which broke in 1918. School attendance laws were always a joke until suddenly, between 1905 and 1930, the police and the courts became actively engaged in their enforcement. The reasons publicly used to justify this enormous upheaval in family life and cultural traditions were threefold and very, very traditional. We were told that this forced schooling would make people better, would make them better citizens, and would make each person his or her own personal best. That was the public story given out. But privately, the founders of institutional schooling sang a different tune to one another. Daniel Webb supported public schools on the grounds that they would serve as a political. Edwards called on the capitalists of his state to support compulsion laws and contribute money, quote, to give security to your own property. The National Teachers Association, which was the forerunner of the NEA, praised Horace Mann's fifth report to the Boston School Committee as having, quote, probably done more than all others to convince capitalists that school is to their direct material advantage. Horace Mann advocated universal education, quoting again, as the best insurance against mobocracy. In spite of the overwhelming public love affair with schooling that we find in contemporary America, our national literature holds numerous and surprisingly consistent statements of compulsory schooling's true purposes. For example, the famous H.L. Mencken wrote in the American Mercury for April 1924 that the aim of public education, this will be a long quote, is not to fill the young with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The aim is simply to reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent and originality. That is the aim, said Mencken, in the United States, and that is its aim elsewhere. In what might seem today to be a masterful insight, Mencken's article traced the template for our own educational system back to the now-vanished military state of Prussia. And he was perfectly right. Our educational system really is Prussian in origin. I'll try to prove that now. The odd fact of Prussian provenance for our schools pops up again and again once you've been alerted to see what's under your nose. William James referred frequently to Prussia around 1900. You've just heard Mencken in 1924. Horace Mann's famous seventh report to the Boston School Committee in 1843 is a paean of homage to the land of Baron von Steuben, who, by the way, wasn't a baron. It's not even clear whether he was a Prussian or not, but that's how he sold himself to the American Revolutionary Army. I think he was a barber's son. The hero of Christopher Lash's The True and Only Heaven, the unique Orestes Brownson, publicly denounced the Prussianization of American education way back in the 1840s, 160 years ago. That Prussian culture loomed large in America is not surprising given our early positive associations with that utopian militaristic state. We may well owe our very freedom to the fact that hired Prussian mercenaries made up a significant proportion of the American army in the Revolution. Those Hessians you read about weren't so Hessian after all, although there were a few Hessians. As many Prussians fought for us as they did for the British. In fact, our revolution is in some sense a civil war between two groups of Prussians. So we were going to be stuck one way or another. Sometime after the war ended, the King of Prussia was called upon to determine our very border with Canada out west. That's why there's a town called King of Prussia outside of Philadelphia. Along the way, our leadership acquired a taste for one of the worst aspects of Prussian culture, an educational system deliberately designed as a tool of state to produce dull intellect, to hamstring the inner life, to deny most of the young the opportunity to learn leadership. This system was meant to ensure a common population composed of incomplete citizens who would be completed by managerial formulae. in order to render the populace scientifically manageable. Prussian schooling is a system of habit training and attitude adjustment. Now you know why all those bells ring. It's a system of habit training, the same way you use with your pet rat. It's a hothouse of psychological strategies to create efficiency in government and industry. In Prussia, people weren't people, they were human resources. Does that sound familiar? It was from James Bryant Conant, president of Harvard for 30 years, a World War I poison gas specialist. He was the co-inventor of Lewisite gas. A World War II high executive on the atomic bomb project, the high commissioner of the American zone in post-World War II Germany, and truly one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, Conant was, that I personally first got wind of the actual purposes of American schooling. Without Conant, we would not have the style and the degree of standardized testing we enjoy today, nor would we be blessed with those gargantuan high schools warehousing 2,000 to 5,000 bodies like the famous Columbine in Littleton, Colorado. Shortly after I quit school teaching, I picked up Conant's 1959 book-length essay entitled The Child, the Parent, and the State, and was more than a little intrigued to see him mention in passing that the modern schools we attend were the results of a revolution, one engineered between 1905 and 1930. A revolution? I'm a pretty decent history buff, and yet no inkling of a school revolution had ever before wafted into my ken, even though both my parents had been schooled during the years in question. Conant didn't bother to elaborate about this revolution, but he did refer the curious to a book published in 1918 by a fellow named Alexander Ingalls. I had never heard of Ingalls, and you probably have never heard of him. Has anyone in this room ever heard of Alexander Ingalls? Well, you're Roland raised his hand. That's because I won't let him alone. If you pass by Harvard someday and are curious, it turns out that the honor lecture in education at Harvard is named after the bozo and has been since 1926. So he must be somebody, right? Conant implied that reading Ingalls' book, Principles of Secondary Education, would answer all my questions. And I think you'll agree that I'm right. Anybody sensible will follow sensible orders. The second function, which Ingalls calls the integrating function, should be relabeled the conformity function for clarity. What nobody ever bothered to teach us is that the centralized management of a mass production economy and an elite-directed social order. If you say we don't have an elite-directed social order, then what are all these skull and bones presidents about and all these Yale graduates? What nobody ever taught us is that the centralized management of these things of necessity demand that the mass of ordinary people be made predictable. Predictable by the tools of statistics. They need to be highly susceptible to fairly crude propaganda, so that the economic and social imbalances that inevitably turn up can be corrected with reasonable speed and dispatch by our managers through continuous exhortations delivered to the mass media or openly through advertising, semi-covertly through the skillful rhetoric emanating from one leadership center or another, including all of our major colleges, without exception, and also rendered with a fair degree of subtlety by the ancient and modern art of spin. Familiar school routines and rewards are designed to make children as alike as possible to further these ends of prediction and propaganda susceptibility. Number three, what Ingalls calls
Ingalls calls the diagnostic directive function is a necessary prelude to running a planned economy and a planned society, which, in case you haven't noticed, is exactly what we've become since the end of the Second World War. School is a major way the trick is pulled off. School is meant to determine each student's proper social role and proper economic role so that we won't have too many chiefs and not enough Indians. Along with the differentiating function, which comes next, school diagnosis enables our managers to control the number of butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers with a fair degree of precision, and to control the number of doctors, lawyers, architects, and other license-bound professionals almost perfectly. Number four, the differentiating function is seen clearly if we just change the title to the sorting function. Once diagnosis is completed, children are to be sorted by the future roles they will be directed to and trained only so far as their destination in the social machine merits, not one step further. The sentimental hope that each kid will be assisted to some personal best is ground to powder by the gears of differentiation. Number five is probably the creepiest. The selective function is easy to mistake for what it is not. It does not refer to any free will decision at all, but only to the inexorable decisions of nature and biology. The selection implied here is the so-called natural selection of Darwin's grown-up fables. Indeed, if you consider it carefully, it has an uncanny resemblance to John Calvin's idea of predestination. Eric Schultes, are you listening? That is, Calvin said the saved and the doomed are selected in advance, prior to birth. He said elected, but selected, elected. As the British poet Edward Fitzgerald said to his alter ego, Omar Khayyam, there's nothing to be done about this. Omar used somewhat more eloquent language, of course. The implications of this for forced government schooling are so profound that only an imbecile could miss them, since only a small percentage of all available breeding stock is actually evolving according to Darwin himself, and since nothing can be done educationally to increase this number, analysis will suggest that provisions have to be made by responsible authorities to render harmless the evolutionarily retarded and overwhelming fraction of the entire human race, according to Mr. Darwin. And to arrange social relations, these authorities will have to do, in such a way that the danger of crossbreeding between the good stuff and the bad stuff is minimized. Authorities will also have to stack the deck in favor of the evolutionarily advanced to keep them from being overwhelmed by the dead ends who vastly outnumber them. Think of the warrior race of Aryans shown besieged in the Vedas by a horde of alien adversaries looking like the orcs in Lord of the Rings. And you'll get some idea, of course we're the orcs, you get some idea of the way Darwin's favored handful was regarded by architects of forced schooling like Edward Thorndike or William Torrey Harris, who was the first national superintendent of schools, and the way the rest of us were discussed in Boston drawing rooms or in Yale seminars. That's the selective function for you in all its curious beauty. And now, for my friend in the beautiful T-shirt down front, the last school function carries a fancy Latin name, the propaedeutic function, which is the logical culmination of this truly revolutionary pedagogy hidden among English-leaden sentences. Propaedeutic means preparing the soil to accept your crop and planting that crop so that it will perpetuate itself forever. First, the entire population of youth has to be conditioned so thoroughly that the new comprehensively managed world it will eventually enter and serve will seem to be as natural as the movements of the sun and the moon. That's hardly possible to take exception to or to imagine any other way to arrange things if you succeed. And second, a small fraction of the young has to be selected out to become the leaders of tomorrow, charged with transmitting this new moral world to the next generation, and so on and on and on. That's what the elite private boarding academies are for. The bells, buzzers, horns, blackboards, humiliations, standardized tests, grades, shouts, orders, pleas for permission to urinate, threats, insults, random violence, bad food, shabbily dressed attendants called teachers, even the random kindnesses at the hands of these total strangers are the preparation for the larger group. And the elite classes in the elite public schools like Stuyvesant in New York City, where Roland went, or Hollywood High in Los Angeles, but particularly in the elite private boarding schools like Andover, which George Bush attended, or St. Albans, which Al Gore attended, or St. Paul's, which Massachusetts Senator Kerry attended, or the Episcopal High, probably the most aristocratic of all these schools, that Arizona Senator John McCain attended, you know, the great populist, or the Choate that JFK attended, or the Groton that Franklin Delano Roosevelt attended, or the same Groton that Teddy Roosevelt attended. Do I have your attention by now? These places train the management of the future, even if the trainees don't understand what's going on, as most don't. In this way, modern schooling stands guard over the most radical project of social engineering in human history. Each new generation has a preordained control group, leavened, it's true, by an admixture drawn from beneath, not out of kindness, but to bleed possible troublemakers from the common classes. That little trick was discovered by two Italian intellectuals who weren't particularly friendly with one another. They discovered it independently at the end of the 19th century, that the way to stop history, to stop the destruction of the control groups and their replacement by others, was simply to bleed away the leadership from the lesser classes who produced the opposition and eventually the overthrow, to bleed them away and condition them. That's why Harlem kids are taken into Groton. In order to keep this, if you believe that I've just described a gigantic conspiracy, you are dead wrong. And when you realize how dead wrong you are, that this isn't a conspiracy, you will be in a position to cause these people fits. And I will explain now why it isn't a conspiracy. When you bought your last package of chicken parts, or slabs of beef, or a side of salmon, did you think you were participating in a conspiracy against the lives of these animals? It's a ridiculous idea, isn't it? QED, you and I are the chickens, the beef, and the fish. In order to keep this thing running, some of us must be taught and bribed to watch over and control a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered incomplete in order that government might proceed efficiently and the corporate economy will never want for labor or willing customers. There you have it. Now you know we do not need Karl Marx's conception of a grand warfare between the classes to see that it is always in the interests of management, whether economic or political, to dumb people down, to demoralize them, to waste their time with water skiing when they ought to be preparing for death, not playing. It is always in the interests of management to divide us from one another and to discard contrarians when they fail to conform. Class may frame the proposition, as when Woodrow Wilson, president of Princeton University, said this to the Federation of High School Teachers in New York in 1912. He actually did say this. We want one class of person to have a liberal education. We want another class of person, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks. Class may frame the proposition, but the motives behind the disgusting decisions that bring about these ends need not be class-based at all. They can be greed-based, fear-based, or self-love-based, or even grounded in the utopian dreams, such as the belief that efficiency is the paramount virtue, not liberty, love, laughter, not faith, hope, or charity. Go back in your imagination to the decades after 1870. That's just after the end of the Civil War. Vast fortunes were waiting to be made in a spanking new world based upon unlimited cheap energy in the form of coal and oil in endless quantities in the United States, a situation which had never existed before in human history. It is no accident that forced schooling comes to the 21st century out of the combined actions of the world's four great coal powers of the 19th century, Germany, Great Britain, France, and the United States. That is not serendipity, that is design. It was George Peabody who invested heavily in the railroad which brought coal out of Pennsylvania into New England, who underwrote Horace Mann's activities in Boston. Peabody, who looked the other way while 8-year-old boys and girls, not a few but a lot, about half of the coal miners in the 19th century were 8 years old because their little bodies could squirm through the little tunnels better. And Peabody, who banked the gold from this success. Peabody exists in every history of schooling as one of the benevolent godfathers of the enterprise. He is credited with establishing through his Peabody Education Fund systems of schooling in the prostrate postbellum South. He's credited with underwriting state school organizations that replaced local organizations. He is the angel who saw to the consolidation of rural schools into districts and in establishing teacher training colleges, Prussian style. Peabody was instrumental in seeing to it that the South got the same sort of Prussian schooling as the North was enjoying. What makes this doubly interesting is that Mr. Peabody did his great work for our schools from London, where he was in residence as J.P. Morgan's partner. Interesting, huh? I'm going to avoid sarcasm when I tell you that one of his nieces was a crucial link in the transatlantic chain which brought Frederick Froebel's German invention of kindergarten, we even retained the German word for this adventure into synthetic family, into the eastern United States. And by the way, if any of you have the patience to go to the 11th edition Encyclopedia Britannica, not any of the junk that followed, the 11th edition, and I think it's published about 1910, you will discover that the inventor of kindergarten, Frederick Froebel's greatest disappointment in life was that he was turned down for induction into the Prussian army because he was an Austrian, and he never forgot the disappointment. That should give a different shading to your thoughts, your conventional thoughts about kindergartens and what their purposes are. Another niece of George Peabody became the second Mrs. Horace Mann, and marvelous to say it, while he was organizing the system of schooling imposed upon the South's ordinary children, George Peabody was at one and the same time found in Groton the single most elite private boarding school of them all, the school which gave us both Roosevelt presidencies, Republican and Democrat. But Peabody was only one of the leadership group who understood that Prussian systematic schooling could create a harmless electorate and a servile labor force, in addition to a vast herd of mindless consumers. His great peers of the next generation, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Astor, Vanderbilt, together with the peerless J.P. Morgan and a relative handful of other principals, came to recognize that a perpetual profit machine and a wonderfully stable society could be had by cultivating and tending just such a herd. Mandatory public schooling was to be the barn where the cows are milked. None of the principals had much schooling or any themselves except J.P. Morgan, and he had been schooled for a time in, yes, you guessed it, Prussia. My motive for providing such a detailed historical case to you is not at all to promote mudslinging or adversarial shouting matches or even a feeling of holier than thou or the demonization of men who, after all, sincerely believed with a religious fervor that they were bringing about a better world, a Darwinian world. My motive is to bring before you the true nature of the ideological machine which you contend with daily. No one you can visibly see in authority and attack has any power at all to change anything, except in the rare case when you can turn them into saboteurs of the system which feeds them and gives them status. The only power granted to principals, to superintendents, or to state education department employees, including the chancellor, the only power granted is a negative power to retard change. It's true that an occasional maverick like Debbie Meyer or Dennis Lipke is allowed, seemingly, to slip through the net, but never enough of those to threaten system integrity, and only enough, keep Orwell in mind, and only enough to provide a smokescreen of counter-propaganda against the gathering storm of school critics. Even the system's enemies are its friends. Paradoxically enough, I don't think you can best this system until you thoroughly understand that a mass production economy simply cannot exist without guaranteed and continuous mass consumption. It's really like putting a bell on a cat. Once somebody says that to you, if you allow yourself to think about it, you will see that it's inexorable. There is no other way. These machines cost so much to build and so much to modify and so much to junk and replace that no one with money can afford to gamble that you won't buy the junk that the machines produce. People who consider it unnatural and unwise to buy things they don't need are murderous villains in the economic scenario we live in. They jeopardize everything, and that's not only the profits of the rich. Millions of people lose their jobs when you and I don't do our part, don't continuously buy, don't continuously become bored with what we buy, and discard it while it has years of use left in it. Nor are there any jobs for these people discarded when we don't buy to go to. So they drop from the tax rolls, social services are slashed, the cops go to work smashing heads, you know the drill. To keep this economy healthy requires that most of us become unhealthy and stay that way. Incomplete human beings dedicated to consumption and to measuring value in our lives by how much stuff we have. School's role in this is crucial, although somewhat indirect. As long as school discourages the development of critical minds and personal independence, the young are sitting ducks for the single greatest occupation of the modern era. Not nuclear physics or rocket science, marketing. Marketing is the science of overcoming sales resistance. And for marketers, two groups are money in the bank: addicts, people with addictive personalities, and children. I'm not talking about addicts to drugs, addicts to gadgets, addicts to clothing, addicts to gambling, addicts to TV, addicts to food, addicts to mass entertainment. Addicts and children can easily be convinced to consume more than they need. School has done a wonderful job of turning children into a particular kind of addict, into those addicts dependent upon the opinions of others. But it has done a spectacular job of freezing our kids into childishness, often into lifelong childishness, like this old geezer water scheme. Wish you could get him back up there. I hope you realize now that this is no accident. Social theorists from Plato to Pestalozzi, from Rousseau to our own Dr. Engels, knew well and explicitly taught, for those who know how to read critically, that if children could be kept childish far beyond the natural term, if they could be kept cloistered with other children in a society of children, if they could be stripped of heavy responsibility, denied a full range of adult associations, denied the right and the necessity of taking risks, including dangerous risks, if they could be encouraged to express a range of trivializing emotions like greed, envy, jealousy, rage, and fear, on the justification that, after all, they're only children. If all these things could be imposed upon children, they would grow older, but they would never grow up. In his once widely known and widely praised History of Education, Dr. Elwood P. Cubberley detailed and praised the procedures through which childhood had been deliberately extended. He was writing back in 1919, and he said from 2 to 6 years, depending on the particular state in question. As I calculated it last week, using Cubberley's formula and his logic, which measures childhood by how long compulsory tutelage can be imposed, we have, by 2001, extended childhood uniformly in all the states by at least 8 years over where it rested before the First World War, before the Cubberley gang got to work. If preschool and obligatory college are factored in, then we have considerably imposed it considerably longer than that. This same Elwood P. Cubberley was once Dean of Teacher Education at Stanford, and he was a professional colleague of Alexander Engels at Houghton Mifflin. He was editor of the secondary school division, and Engels was editor of the primary school division. He was also a longtime friend and correspondent of James Bryant Conant of Harvard. In the 1922 edition of his book, Public School Administration, Conant wrote this: "Our schools are factories in which the raw products, children, are to be shaped and fashioned into finished products, and it is the business of the school to build its pupils according to the specifications laid down." Is that plain enough for everyone here? A look around our society today reflects just what those specifications were, are, and will remain unless you do something about it. Maturity has been banished from nearly every aspect of our lives. Some of us think nothing of encouraging old men with money to hand over their money to the safekeeping of strangers who urge them to go water skiing. The chutzpah is breathtaking, but of course no more so than the recent financial world's adventure with CEOs who bankrupt their own companies with impunity, who walk away from the wreckage with hundreds of millions of dollars and who escaped the carnage unscathed, while tens of thousands of their pensioners and near pensioners, too old to start again, are reduced to living out their lives in penury. It isn't the dishonesty that impresses me. It isn't the collusion of the past two presidencies in this, and probably a whole string of them back to the Second World War. It's the brass, the colossal brass, which shows me how disrespected the well-schooled public really is by our leadership. It's like the flagrant bully, confident of his overwhelming strength, stealing from the weak and then brazenly saying, "What are you going to do about it?" I can understand, admire, and respect those who steal away from this contest to homeschool or to fashion alternative schools. But if that's the only response, the day is going to come when this bully wants you. When the bully who owns the courts, the legislature, the executive branch, the IRS, and the police won't be content to allow you to play utopian games, the day will come when he comes for you too. You have to do your part directly to sabotage this thing. There was not a single day I went to work as a school teacher in New York City, even those days when I was New York State Teacher of the Year, when I did not have a clear intention in my mind to wreak some harm to forced institutional schooling. And I'm not talking about generically. If I told you some of the details of how I did that, I would be arrested and thrown in jail. But when I say that you owe the rest of us, especially us old guys, some regular acts of sabotage, I mean just that. It isn't hard to do. Systems are all vulnerable, and complex systems are tremendously vulnerable. There's no such thing as a secure system. Thank you. A look around our society today shows how childish we have all become. Easy divorce laws remove the need to work at relationships. Easy credit removes the need to learn self-control and fiscal discipline. Easy communications seem to make a lot of people feel that it's okay to impose their idiotic banter on strangers in elevators, on airplanes, and everywhere else in violation of some fundamental bargain we ought to have about privacy and solitude and public space. I'm talking about cell phones. Easy entertainment has destroyed our motive to learn how to amuse ourselves. A professional standing army removes the universal obligation to personally share in the risks of national defense. We have become a nation of children happy to surrender our independent judgment to propaganda which would insult actual grown-up adults. We buy televisions, then the things we see on television, computers, and the things for sale on computers. We buy $200 sneakers. Nike just crossed that sound barrier, whether we can afford them or not. And when they fall apart too soon, as they have been designed to do, there was a test published two or three months ago. I just didn't have time to log it carefully, but showed that the $10 and $15 sneakers you buy in the bargain stores are better constructed than the $200 sneakers. They last longer. We drive dangerous SUVs and tell ourselves the lie that they're safer than small cars, even when we're upside down in them. And worst of all, we don't bat an eyelash when Ari Fleischer tells us that Americans, quote, must be careful what they say and do. Someone should have pulled out a pistol and shot him between the eyes right on the spot. And if I get much older, I'll be the one to do it. So we buy that one too. Our schooling is seen to it. Now for the good news. Unfortunately, there's only a single page left in this script, so there's not. But there's a lot of good news. It's just that the bad news plays better. Now for the good news. Once you understand the schemes of modern schooling, what it's up to precisely, think of Engel's six functions, its tricks and traps are fairly easy to avoid. School trains children to be employees and consumers. Train your own kids to be leaders, adventurers, and stoics like Lance Armstrong. Getting outside the box is not very hard to do if you think of it this way. Well-schooled people are trained to obey reflexively. Train your own to think critically and independently. Well-schooled children have a low threshold of boredom because they have only the flimsiest inner life to fall back upon. Help your own to develop an inner life by insisting on serious stuff in history, literature, philosophy, music, art, economics, theology, the whole shooting match. Everything known to furnish the spirit abundantly. And always remember, school boys and girls out of these voices constantly, through TV, radio, landline and cell phone, through computer, through pop journalism, and a succession of shallow friendships, quickly acquired, quickly abandoned, and utterly undependable. Teach your kids to love being alone as much as they love company. That's the good dialectic. Challenge your kids with plenty of solitude. It is the only way to learn how to enjoy your own company. Show them how to conduct inner dialogues, and if you don't know how to do that, learn. To be quit of the school nightmare demands that we wake up first to what schools have become. At the best, they're a jobs project for worthless jobs that the human race doesn't need. At the best, that's what they are. At the worst, they're laboratories of experimentation on young minds. They're drill centers for the habits and attitudes which corporate society demands. Level with kids candidly. Make a bond with them to allow important relationships, even with the town bum, and important adventures. Make a bond with them not to treat them as children if they're older than 7 years. Don't extend their childhoods, not even for a day. If David Farragut could command a warship at the age of 12, if George Washington could study trigonometry as his first school subject at the age of 11, when all of his friends said he had an ordinary mind, if Thomas Edison could run a successful business 1,000 miles from home completely on his own at age 12, if Benjamin Franklin could work 60 hours a week at the same age, then put himself through a course of study which would choke a Yale senior today, then your kids can do it too, and so can you. Never pat yourself on the back, even for a job well done. As long as we have 80-year-old fools water skiing, we're in a desperate situation where someday somebody is going to set off a hydrogen bomb just to feel that they've done something significant. Harper's Magazine published something that I didn't see anywhere else. They published an excerpt from the diary of one of those kids who shot up Columbine High School. And the diary said, I mean, the kid was, what, 15, 16, 17 years old? He said that he had never been allowed to do a single significant thing in his life, but he was going to change that. Your kids need to feel they've done something significant. They don't need to feel good. They need to feel they've done something significant besides playing games. After a long life, which included 30 years on the front lines in junior high school trenches, I concluded against my own Ivy League training that human genius is as common as dirt and that the bell curve isn't a permanent phenomenon. It's an artifact of our bad practices. Thank you. I think that we suppress universal genius because nobody, and I mean nobody, as yet understands how you would manage a population of truly educated men and women. But 30 years in the classroom taught me that it's fairly simple to do and a glorious thing to witness when it's done. You don't manage them. You show them how to manage themselves. Thank you very much. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience. Hours and hours listening to me drone on.